indicators of arson. And so there are an awful lot of fires in any state, and a heck of a percentage of those were being labeled as arson because they were applying these indicators the way an earlier generation had applied the rules of defining a witch.
So in your professional opinion, what is your profession? What do you do, and how are you titled?
Well, my oldest profession, the thing I have been continuously for 50 years, is a chemist, Cambridge PhD chemist. But I my professional career began during the moon race and Vietnam. I was involved with rocket propellants during the moon race, and at about the same period of time as Vietnam heated up, I got into covert warfare, and that is methods of torching enemy infrastructure or blowing it up behind enemy lines using indigenous materials.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, government funded study of what amounts to arson.
Are you a pioneering scientist in this field, or were there other scientists in this field?
Well, there are a few of us. I would like to think I was one of the pioneers in this. John Lentini is certainly a pioneer, and Craig Beiler certainly is, and Mr. Kennedy, who founded the NAFI, National Association of Fire Investigators, Dan Churchward, and a number of the people who sit on the NFPA 921 committee.
And in your professional opinion,
yes,
you don't think your peers would have argued with you about this case? This is clearly not an arson.
Oh, no, they certainly would not argue with me about that. The case has now been looked at by a large number of those peers, and quite honestly, any fairly well trained individual with some experience in fire investigation and some knowledge of science, it would immediately see that this is a highly flawed case. I've never had any of my peers challenge me on any of this, except initially in 2004, when I first began accusing them of shoddy practices.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I got a lot of hate mail from fire marshals around the country. But when I did a document release and made the documents available to anybody who wanted them, it turned out they all agreed with me, even the people who had yelled the loudest at me.
Well, Mr. Hurst, I really appreciate you joining Execution Watch tonight, because we're having an examination of this case again on our regular program, and we appreciate your calling in. Did you have a question?
No, sir, I don't.
Susan, I was asking Susan if she had a question.
Yes, I would like to ask Dr. Hirsch, when your report went to the governor's office, were you surprised that it essentially fell on deaf ears, or was that something you expected?
Yeah, I expected it.
Okay.
I've been doing arson cases for a long, long time, and has already done quite a number of cases.
Okay.
At that time, of bogus arson cases, and I wasn't surprised at all. I'm not surprised that that they're still fighting us. You know, people like the governor and the Texas State Fire Marshal's office. And
people have egos.
They have egos.
Mr. Hurst, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. I was just informed technologically we've had a difficulty here, and that difficulty is that our first 7 minutes was overshorn by BBC. So my name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. Larry Douglas's fine introduction has been mixed with BBC report, and that can't be reproduced at this period. But who we've been talking to is Gerald Hirsch, and Gerald is a forensics expert. Actually, he tells me he's a chemist, and he is involved in research, sometimes for war purposes, in the investigation of fires. I have to call back and realize what we had talked about in the first 7 minutes, but in his professional opinion, the fire that killed Todd Willingham's children was not an arson. He said that the state looked at it, so ruled it, presented it in evidence. He corrected that with the accurate science. That science was given to the governor's office to be shared with the Board of Pardons and Paroles and the governor, and nothing was done at that level to halt or delay Mr. Willingham's execution. Again, I'm Ray Hill. We're talking about the execution of Todd Willingham, which happened some time ago, and we're re-examining the case. He was executed on February the 17th, 2004, and this case is not going away. It was in the media just yesterday when the district attorney that prosecuted or that was moved to the Science Commission by the governor got into trouble for withholding exculpatory evidence on a man that was exonerated and released from Texas prison. That was not a capital case, but he was released from Texas prison recently. Susan Ashley is here with us. And Susan, are you going to recall what happened in this case, or do we need to go back through that?
Well, essentially, the simple version of the story is this. Mr. Willingham was home. It was December 23rd, 1991, with his three children. The house caught on fire. He was able to escape the house. The three children, there were three little girls, they were not able to escape. His wife was out shopping, and that's your basic facts. What really happens at trial is that there's an arson. Obviously, the fire department comes. They call for their arson investigators, and they do, I guess, what you would call their classic story, that the fire was started by arson. Accelerators were used, and they listed a number of indicators that to them, where they concluded that a liquid accelerant was used, and therefore it was arson. Other things, Todd Willingham may not have been a model citizen. However, the arson investigation and what they concluded was simply wrong. It was bad science. It was wrong. It's been discredited over and over and over again. And that's Dr. Hirsch first was contacted right before his execution. His report basically refuted what the state's experts had testified, what their conclusions were. Dr. Hirsch scientifically refuted it as being scientifically incorrect. And then other reports following Dr. Hirsch, there was a report by Dr. John Lantini, who did a report at the request of the Innocence Project. His findings essentially are consistent with Dr. Hirsch's. And then later, the Texas Forensic Science Commission commissioned a report from Dr. Craig Baylor, and Dr. Baylor's report is basically consistent with Dr. Hirsch and John Lantini.
So there's no real scientific report that this was an arson. All you have, basically, is the initial investigation, and we've identified that earlier when Professor Hirsch was on the phone, Dr. Hirsch was on the phone, that that's largely folklore.
Well, what Dr. Hirsch and what was commonly done in fire investigations were they would see things, and they would attribute certain things, such as burn patterns, such as burning under furniture, such as what they would describe as puddle marks on the floor, things like that they would interpret as evidence of a liquid accelerant being used. They would also say things like the fire burned very hot and very fast, and they would attribute that to a liquid accelerant.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a well-known case called the Lime Street Fire, and in that case, Dr. Lantini and I believe John Dehannon, they were hired, I believe, by the state. And what they did is there was an arson case where a duplex home was burnt. They got another duplex home that I guess was structurally very much the same. They furnished it in the same way as the home that did burn, and they conducted an experiment where they lit it on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is they ended up with the same evidence of the home that where somebody was charged with arson. Mm-hmm. And in their experiment, what it showed them is the same thing without a liquid accelerant gave them the same type of evidence.
Okay, I'm going to bring Larry in here because I have a question for both of the attorneys. Susan Ashley is a practicing attorney, so is Larry Douglas. Why is it that the... you're going to move that mic. Okay, why is it that the appellate effort did not catch this? Why is this all on the governor and the Board of Pardons and Paroles? Larry, why don't you take this microphone and give Susan back her microphone? That way your lawyers can get into a discussion.
You're going to have to move closer.
Well, in the appellate record, the only thing that... In an appeal, they're limited to the record of what evidence was presented at trial. So on appeal, they cannot present new evidence. And what happened in this case is Dr. Hirsch was not contacted till shortly before Willingham was going to be executed. So prior to Dr. Hirsch's report, there was no evidence at all. There was no report. There was no expert opinion at all that the arson testimony in the Willingham trial was scientifically faulty. And in other words, the evidence was there all the time. There was evidence in the home, in the structure, but how the fire investigators interpreted that evidence was scientifically incorrect. And so even at the last minute, although, it seems like most people would think that the governor would have granted a stay. However, as Walter Reeves, Willingham's attorney, said, technically it was not newly discovered evidence. Rather, it was a new analysis of old evidence.
Well, I understand that part of it. But even if the governor had granted a 30-day stay, that would only give them time to go back to court with this. Why wasn't this issue brought up in a court somewhere? Because that's all you would have gotten from the governor is a 30-day stay.
Well, I think they had exhausted. I think at that point, I think they had exhausted all their remedies. I mean, because the report, they had exhausted their appeals. I think they had exhausted their writ process.
So it is your opinion that if the governor had granted a 30-day stay, he was just putting off the execution?
That's hard for me to say. Perhaps that could be true. The only thing now, another part of this is, okay, if you follow Hirsch's report, what you take away from it is that there was no crime of arson committed at all. So if there was no crime of arson committed at all, it would be evidence of Willingham's innocence. However, what the state did, that's where the state, I believe, was trying to respond to that when they went and got an affidavit. I believe it's from Willingham's wife's brother, and the affidavit, I believe, was that he said that she said that Willingham admitted to her that he committed the crime, the arson, that he did it intentionally. And that's why I think at the last minute the state probably went and got that affidavit, strange as it is.
If I may just...
Larry, okay, Elizabeth wants to weigh in here.
Well, I interviewed Todd's defense attorney, and I was very struck by this man's telling me that Todd was a dangerous man, and if he ever got out... that it would be a danger to society. And I thought, that's very strange coming from his defense attorney. And I think had Todd had a better defense attorney, he might have had the arson investigated. Isn't that a possibility? That,
well, let me clarify. I believe what Liz is talking about is the trial attorney,
right,
not the attorneys on the writ or the petition for clemency. Now, the trial attorney, I did see, I also saw him on a interview where he believed Willingham was guilty. I would say this much, that any attorney representing Willingham, if they could, the logical thing would be to try to engage a fire science expert and to have a credible scientific expert make a determination as to the likelihood of this being intentionally set or an accidental fire.
Where would his lawyer in, what's the name of the town up there? Corsicana, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Where would his lawyer get resources to hire an expert witness?
I mean, he would have to, I believe, my guess is this case was probably court-appointed. I believe what he would have to do is go to the judge and request funds to hire an expert. And I don't think, I mean, I think he should have done that, for one thing. Perhaps the lawyer did not, perhaps the lawyer was convinced that it was arson. I don't know. But that's really what he needed. Because had he been able to hire a real scientific expert, I think this case would have changed. I don't think he would have been convicted.
Larry, do you want to weigh in on any of this?
Well, Ray, you were asking about the appellate process, and our appellate process in this country is pretty streamlined. It's not like I think the Amanda Knox case is present on a lot of people's mind now, how the Italian system is, where you have, in essence, a brand-new trial. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen here. So the process is, if there's going to be a disputed forum, that's going to be in the trial case, trial before the jury. Beyond that, the appellate process, whether it's the writ process or the appeals, are looking primarily for things that went wrong, not in accordance with the law, in the actual trial before the jury. So if there was going to be any contest of the supposed expert testimony, the science that would have been done in the trial. Now we talk about science, but the fact is, expert testimony is just really opinion. Mm-hmm. And so it's incumbent upon both sides. I mean, this is a contested matter. So I've even seen each side can pretty much get an expert to say almost anything they want them to. So it would have been incumbent upon the defense lawyer to either contest the purported science that the prosecutor offered, or to get his own expert.
You know, I would point out this, that there are some scientific principles that are, shall we say, universally accepted among scientists. And a scientific opinion, if it's based on evidence and if it's based on valid principles that are recognized by throughout the community of scientists, it's that opinion is an opinion that's based upon valid science.
Well, an opinion in this case based on valid science would certainly beat the hell out of the folklore that was presented at trial.
Yes.
There's no question about that. The problem that I'm having is that at the last minute, and you understand, mm-hmm, that I'm against executions,
sure,
completely, and one of the things I especially don't like about executions is this rush to the last minute. Everybody's playing chicken, where the lawyers are screaming and yelling, and the clock is ticking, and somebody's about to get killed, and it's all of that. I don't know, from what I have heard here today, that a 30-day stay from the governor would have done anything except delay this execution. Now, if they had a 30-day delay, could they have taken Mr. Hurst's report and turned it into an actual innocence claim, would that have gotten them back to a court or what?
I think that's the reason that the state got the affidavit from the wife's brother was to, shall we say, head off, in other words, to counter the actual claim of innocence. That would be the only reason I can think of that they would get that affidavit. And that's exactly what I think the state wanted to do to counter an actual claim of innocence, because if there was no arson, absent other evidence, such as a confession, essentially there's no crime.
So they countered this.
Put that microphone close to Elizabeth, because I'm going to start asking Elizabeth questions.
They countered the information about this new investigation with repeated accusations about Todd's character, which was a big part of the punishment phase of the trial. So that I find disturbing. They didn't react to this new information with another scientific opinion. They went to the brother of Stacy, and he made a statement saying that the wife said that Todd said that he had committed the crime, which is contrary to what she said during the trial and after the trial when I interviewed her in 2000.
Liz Gilbert, excuse me for shortening the name there. Elizabeth Gilbert is a writer. She's a performer. She's done remarkable work. And you got to know Todd Willingham personally. The rest of us have read about this case. You have actually touched and listened to Todd Willingham as a playwright and written something of his story. How did you get to know Todd in the first place?
It was interesting because my ex-husband at the time was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and my parents were getting rather elderly, and I was kind of at a loss of something to get my mind off of these things, and I saw a poster for to take a trip against the death penalty to go to Philadelphia with a group here from Houston, and it looked like a nice distraction, so I took the weekend and I rode on a bus to Philadelphia to protest the death penalty and specifically the execution or the attempted or the desired execution of Mumia Abdul-Jamal. And on the way back, Gloria Rubeck, who is a very influential activist here in Houston, asked people on the bus if they would be interested in writing someone on death row. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting, and that's why I raised my hand. And it was very, very much fate that Todd's name was the one that was connected with mine.
And so you visited Todd, you got to know him?
Well, I first received a letter from him, and here was this letter, and it was very polite, and it was not self-serving. It was, thank you for taking the time to get to know people on death row and speak out about the conditions here. And that struck me that, okay, here's a person who's, on death row, but he's interested in letting other people on death row get assisted, not just himself. So I did visit him, and on the first visit, I was struck by this very polite person who told me this horrific tale of his trial and what happened. And I went in there with this attitude of, okay, this everybody on death row is innocent, they claim. And so I really thought, okay, I'm going to listen to him, but I'm going to, keep my distance. And so I went to Austin and I read the trial transcripts. And in reading the trial transcripts, then I thought, well, there is something seriously wrong with this case. And it wasn't based upon, Todd's information. It was based upon me reading the trial transcripts.
And as his execution date approached, what does someone in your position do with your friendship, your knowledge, your feelings about a case?
Well, that is probably one of the more difficult things I'm processing right now. About a year before he was executed, I began to realize that this event was going to happen, that he was going to be executed. And he had asked me if I would attend the execution, and I had agreed to do so. And the more I realized that this was going to happen, I became very, I'm sure this was very unconscious, but very busy. I visited less. I didn't write as often. And the following November, I was involved in a car accident. And because of the car accident, I had a very serious injury and I could not attend the execution. So it wasn't really until David Grand from The New Yorker approached me the following year that I even thought seriously about what had happened and had to begin to process the feelings about a sense of, I wish I had done more, I wish I had done it better, and what a terrible injustice had occurred.
So you wrote the play in which he and you are characters.
Well, actually, I wrote the play because it was... I had been writing essays, trying to get attention about his case, writing essays about death row and the conditions on death row. And I had never visited a prison before. And going up to death row and sitting there for 2 hours and watching the other family members, the children, there are women there who are in love with these men, that is very emotionally draining. And I think the play just... became an outlet for the sense of frustration and depression of, you know, having to go up there. And so I wrote about a character who is visiting a man on death row, but about how much life there is on death row. You know, that these men in those 2 hours visit have a chance to see people, to talk to people, to flirt, to engage in conversation, and to be human again. Because basically they're in these 9x12 cages for 23 hours out of the day. And it was appalling.
Well, I can only tempt the listeners that Liz's play is a remarkable piece of work. It's remarkable blocking, remarkable set design. The whole thing, which you were responsible for, is a remarkable piece of lesson in humanity. Are you continue with the same script, or are you rewriting it some?
I have submitted it to a few theaters with the idea of you know, it was really part of Diverse Works had offered me a little opportunity to create some work there in their space. We had been there for a couple weeks. And so it had a production of what I consider a very raw staging. I mean, the staging was excellent. It was directed by Amy Bruce. She did a wonderful job. But as far as the first draft of the play, it needs to be revised. And I do hope to have another production.
What shall people look for when the title surfaces?
It's still release yearning. And it's about the idea of how people on the outside have so many grievances about the difficulties of their life, and the people on the inside have these same issues.
Elizabeth, it's always been wonderful to be your friend and know that, and thank you very much for contributing to today's Execution Watch. You can continue to participate in the discussion, but I'm going to go back to Susan and see where we are and what does our listeners need to know about this case that they're not going to get off of the Huntsville item this week.
First and foremost, if you have an arson case or if you have a pending criminal case that has any, shall we say, scientific question, hire a lawyer and have your lawyer hire an expert immediately, as soon as the case is filed. Because in the Willingham case, let's just hypothetically say Willingham's lawyer had the means and the accessibility to hire a fire scientist right off the bat, before he was even indicted. It's possible this case might not even have been indicted. And so it's much harder once a person is convicted and the trial is over and they did not have an adequate expert for the defense. It's much, much harder later to try to attack the conviction, whether it's on a post-conviction writ or, you know, a petition for clemency. So I would just say hire them early. And, you know, one of the things Dr. Hirsch has worked for years on, before he got involved in criminal cases, he worked for years in the area of civil litigation as a fire expert in cases of civil litigation, where you have you know, industrial plants that have fires, explosions, large businesses that have fires, explosions. And in terms of what for insurance companies and for big businesses, fires generally result in litigation. Litigation is generally to determine liability, and liability may end up costing a business or an insurance company a lot of money. So they were willing to spend money to get the best experts, and it may be that a lot of the advances we have in terms of fire science might have been driven by a lot of the civil litigation that has gone on for years.
As a practicing attorney, tell us about the mechanism of going to judge and asking for expenses for a expert witness.
If the lawyer just simply has to ask the judge, has to state their reason why they need an expert, why the expert is critical for the case. There is case law. There's case law that is basically held that if the lawyer does not do that, it's ineffective assistance of counsel. And so I think the lawyer just has to do that, ask for it, push the matter, and basically insist, if I don't have an expert, I cannot effectively represent my client.
Is there any evidence that was done in this case?
From what I've read, sections of the record, that does not appear to have been the case. I would say no. Liz read the whole record. Liz, what would you say?
Well, in fact, the time I spent visiting Todd, we were trying to figure out who else might have started the fire. It never crossed anybody's mind that these arson experts could have been wrong. And I had read an article about Gerald Hurst and got rather excited about the idea that this might be the key to getting Todd off. And that did not occur until it was probably about 9 months before he was executed.
And by this time, you're dealing with the appellate lawyer. You're not dealing with the trial lawyer at all.
No, and I had gone to visit Mr. Reeves, the appellate lawyer, and it was kind of the same thing. No one had thought to explore the idea of the arson investigation. And that was the sad thing, is that that was where the case turned, and no one in the whole appeals thought of it.
This is Elizabeth, the other Elizabeth, producer Elizabeth. I have a question, and that is that, you know, I'm sitting here listening to an account of all these experts who've become involved in the case and as a result of the case have really educated policymakers and our leaders about modern arson science and what went so wrong in this case. Can we now feel confident that this sort of thing would never happen again? Have leaders pretty much adopted in the modern arson science?
I'm not sure about that, Elizabeth. I would basically say if you have a pending criminal case, I certainly wouldn't count on your fire investigators. I would not count on their opinion. I would hire your own expert. Well, the reason I for a long time, look, firemen and police are kind of like each other's cousins. They sort of have a law enforcement bias. And just like some police see a crime everywhere, I think some arson investigators see arson everywhere. And I would just always hire my own expert. I don't really think you can really depend on them I just don't think you can depend on them. Now, I mean, the Texas Forensic Science Commission has made numerous recommendations. If they're implemented, I think it will improve things. But I don't think you can really make it fail safe like that.
And it's really going to be left up to the trial lawyer to make that call. If the client cannot afford to pay, then surely you can ask the judge just by filing a motion for the appointment and a payment of an expert. Whenever there is purportedly scientific evidence, it just makes sense to have an an expert appointed, whether you're going to use them to testify or just to assist you in evaluating the other expert's testimony. Now, oftentimes on indigent cases, the amount's very low. But there's all sorts of purportedly expert testimony out there. I think in Fort Bend County here, there was an expert supposedly with this dog sniffing cases.
Yeah, right.
But that kind of testimony comes in all the time. And because we relegate our criminal justice to an advocacy system, then it's only going to be as effective as the advocates who are involved in the system itself. So it's incumbent upon the trial lawyer to at least to get an expert to at least evaluate the supposedly scientific information that's being offered by the state.
Would we be discussing this case at all if it weren't for Rick Perry's ambition? Is that what's driving this? I mean, obviously the trial lawyer had screwed up pretty severely. Obviously, folks in Corsicana, Texas, didn't care enough about this man's life to look at it too closely. Obviously, the appellate lawyers didn't have an opportunity to raise issues that were not in the trial. And so we go down to the last few minutes before execution, and the governor said, "I'm going to take a nap." And that was the end of this man's life. And things like this actually happen far more frequently than people realize in Texas. This is just a glaring example. But I am yet to hear from anybody in this room of how that 30-day stay would have gotten the cork out of this bottle so that this case could be reexamined. I don't even think we had a legal standard for an actual innocence claim in 2004.
Well, I think we did have a standard. Yes, I think we had an actual innocence claim has always been a valid claim. And, you know, he might have been able to make...
Well, Scalia has a different opinion about that. Innocence is not important in these cases.
Well, I mean, I think if they had gotten a 30-day stay, they might have been able to file... They possibly could have filed another writ if they were going to claim... They would have to claim newly discovered evidence of actual innocence. Although the evidence had been there, it was a new analysis. So,
I remember a case in which this radio, the prison show was involved in the Clarence Brantley case. I remember going to Charlie Bayard and Sam Houston Clinton on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and saying, "What are you going to do about this judge destroying evidence in this case?" And they said, "How do you know that?" And I said, "Call a clerk." She saw him. But they sent a special judge down here from Amarillo to look into the Clarence Brantley case. And it was based on his ruling that they were able to restart and have another hearing of the evidence and exonerate him. It's not easy to stop that killing process, even with an innocence claim, at least as late as Clarence Brantley.
That is true. And you know, one thing I'd like to say, what the jurors in Corsicana, we can't really say that they didn't care or they didn't care about executing an innocent man. What jurors in Corsicana were, what they got was evidence,
I mean, and they dealt with evidence they had.
Right.
It's just that it's like computers, crap in, crap out.
And the people, they listened to supposed experts who I'm sure testified, shall we say, often in error, but never in doubt, and were very confident of their testimony. And when you have, people have a deference towards police officers and firemen and, I guess, fire investigators. And when you have people that are saying they're experienced, that they're experts, and they're testifying with confidence, and people did not have an expert to refute what they were saying. So the jury really, I don't really see what choice they had based on what evidence was being presented to them.
Well, if you're listening to this program wherever you are, over the internet or over HD3 channel, let me bring something to your attention. Here we have a man, a working class man with a few tattoos and some calluses from hard work, kind of gristle and bone kind of guy, who's trying to do his best to raise three children with his wife, and they get killed. And the next thing that happens in your life is somebody accuses you of murdering them and concoct a story that you know in your heart of heart is not true. You don't know. You know that you didn't spread any accelerant. You know that you didn't start a fire. And everybody is looking at you like you're crazy. Well, if you didn't start it, who did start it? Because the acceptance, as Liz pointed out, that this was an arson. So the issue is, who did the arsoning? Can you imagine the emotional burden of struggling with grief through this false charge?
I mean, to even start off with, if a person escapes a serious fire, such as an electrical fire, they are actually... They're really so freaked out that it's actually hard to think straight, because it is a terrifying experience to escape a fire. And then to hear your children are not alive or killed, his mental state would be, you know, he'd be just traumatized from the whole experience. Now, he maintained his innocence to the very end. He said that repeatedly. He said it before he was executed. And I think at one point that Willingham mentioned something about squirrels in the attic. I think he was alluding to the possibility of an electrical fire.
Yes, and there's something also disturbing about this case, that if the prosecution felt so confident about this arson investigation, and this is what the red flag was for me when I read the case, they got a jailhouse snitch to come in and testify. This is a man who had already been convicted of drug crimes. He came in and he testified that Todd had confessed to the crime. And to me, that said something about the prosecution, that if they really felt that confident about this, what was the purpose of this jailhouse snitch who has since recanted and then recanted his recantation? And I mean, it was horrible.
Liz, I've been to prison. I'll tell you about snitches when we get out of here.
Well, and then on top of that, and one reason I got actively involved in this again was I heard Governor Perry, his response to why he did not give Todd 30 days was that Todd was a monster. And Todd was not a monster. He was a man. And I think he probably suffered a great deal of guilt for waking up and running out of the house and saving himself before he thought about saving his own children. And I have, you know, letters from him that show him, yes, he was an angry person at times, but he was also very compassionate, very caring, and in short, an individual. But he was a young man with tattoos, and he drank beer, and he smoked pot, and he was not a very good husband. But the one thing he was executed for was none of those. It was for starting a fire that didn't happen. So, you know, if there's not an arson, you can't have somebody executed for arson, and that's the problem.
Well, one of the things John Lantini recommended, I read John Lantini's report, and one of the things he recommended was that it could be possible to have a bifurcated trial. Now, what that would mean is first a trial on whether there was an arson at all. I mean, where lawyers or the state could present their experts, defense could present their experts, a juror or a panel, hopefully of people who have some scientific background, would make a determination whether there was an arson at all. And then if there was an arson, then to go on to the next stage of the trial, which is who did the arson? Is the person being charged the person who did it or not? Because you may have situations where, hey, a popular person may start their mansion on fire. An unpopular person who's not a good model citizen may be home and their house started on fire. And so when everything's combined together, I think there's a lot of juror sentiment. I mean, some people are more likable than other people. Some people have better backgrounds than other people. And you have the emotion of the crime, too.
The motivation for doing today's show, of course, was the last voice that you heard before mine started. Susan Ashley is very concerned and takes her work on the Execution Watch show very seriously. And she approached me about the idea of doing this. Seemed to me like a wonderful idea. But I don't think we've ever done one of these shows where we didn't learn more about what was actually going on in the course of the trial than we have this one. And this is the oldest case we've done. The execution's been over since 2004. And all of a sudden we're reexamining it, not for you, but with you. We hope that you keep in mind the margin of error that can happen. Normally we have Jim Skelton here, but he got a lay-in tonight, and so he's not here. I want to thank Susan Ashley for insinuating this program, Larry Douglas for joining us in this program. Gerald Hurst was very helpful. He studies his science, and of course Liz Gilbert is one of the finest writers that I know, and having her in here was wonderful. The next scheduled execution is going to be a Frank Garcia, and that is going to happen during KPFT's fundraiser. So listen very carefully to the last words I have to say. I want to thank very much Elizabeth for producing tonight's show, Susan Ashley for being the co-producer of tonight's show. We are here by virtue of the wizardry of Otis McClay, and our studio engineer has been Doyle. You're hearing Victoria Panetti in the background. KPFT is a listener-sponsored station. We don't have commercials. If you would take the time to go by kpft.org, find that tip jar, and contribute on behalf of the work we are doing on Execution Watch, we would take very kindly to that. This is Ray Hill saying for KPFT Houston, have a good evening.